Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 286. We'll start with the Free State. Its president, Johannes Brand, was certainly carved from an original chunk of Boer marble. Brand was one of the main movers behind the first attempt at uniting the Boer republics of the Transvaal and Orange Free State, but the open hostility by Paul Kruger and the burghers of the Transvaal scuttled his plans. President Brand had been voted into office in 1872, and for the next 20 years the Free State was characterized by relative tranquility and modest prosperity. After Britain formally annexed Basutoland and Griqualand West, Free State experienced a few ructions, but there was little friction between the Afrikaners and their English counterparts. Brandt was steadfast in his belief that the republics should remain neutral when it came to Great Britain, while Paul Kruger's Transvaal was openly hostile to London. The Free State leader was awarded the Knight Grand Cross in the Order of St. Michael and St. George by Queen Victoria in 1882, turning Brandt into Sir Johannes Brandt. That rankled still more. Kruger wanted utter independence, whereas Brandt was willing to negotiate based on what was best for the Free State. A deeply religious man, Johannes Brandt was extremely popular with the burghers of the Free State, and his expression, "Alles zal recht kommen als elkin zijn plicht doet," all will be well if everyone does his duty, one of the most recognizable sayings of his presidency. There weren't serious difficulties with black Free Staters, mainly because in the Free State, blacks had no rights and couldn't own land and avoided the territory. It wasn't like the Cape, where jobs abounded. Black people traveled through the Free State to get to the Cape. In 1885, there were about an equal number of blacks and whites living in the Free State, with the independent Basutoland on the eastern border and the territory around Tabanchu prosperous. The population of the Free State in 1885 was 140,000, smaller than most counties in England at the time, which is even more amazing because the Free State was almost exactly the same size as the whole of England. It's 129,825 square kilometres. England is 130,279 square kilometres. The Free State lay directly between the Cape, which England controlled, and the Transvaal, which it thought of as a suzerainty. The reason for all this preamble is that railways were coming to South Africa, albeit slowly. In 1885, there were only 1,318 miles of track in operation, and 1,213 of those were in the Cape, 115 in Natal. By contrast, 5,133 miles of track had been laid in Australia, and even New Zealand had longer lines, 1,486. All Cape lines ran north from the terminals of Cape Town through to Port Elizabeth and financed by a £7 million loan secured by then Prime Minister Merriman in 1872. By 1884, the lines approached Kimberley, where they were promptly blocked because both the Boer republics of the Orange Free State and Transvaal were unable to raise the cash. It wasn't just the money in the Transvaal's case. It was also the fact that the Republic was dominated by old-fashioned curmudgeons who regarded the puffing and steaming locomotives partly as Satan's minions. There was another strategic reason. Transvaal President Paul Kruger was massaging the wonderful world of geopolitics, and he had his sights set on the eastern line from Pretoria to Delagoa Bay, or possibly to other ports that his diplomats were trying to secure along the east coast seaboard. They hadn't fully given up on the plan to lay lines from Pretoria down through northern Zululand to St. Lucia. Kruger was entertaining ideas of perhaps working with the Germans, who were now eyeing Southwest Africa and Namibia with a renewed interest. This period reminds us of the fairly modern era of politics, where infrastructure growth is peppered with China's Belt and Road promises, the African Development Bank trying to entice South Africa's Public Investment Corporation to invest in Africa-wide infrastructure builds, and that old challenge, vast distances, throwing many plans out of whack. For the erudite and worldly empire builders, the British, Paul Kruger was a conundrum. Some compared him to Edward Cardwell, who was on many minds in 1886. He died that year. Former British Governor Sir Bartle Frere said Kruger was the rugged version of Edward Cardwell, who represents a kind of tedious desk politician, obsessing over fine print, legalities and budgets, refusing to see the grand imperial picture. When Freer met Paul Creer, he expected a wild, simple-minded, backfelt peasant. Instead, he found a man who was shrewd, legally meticulous, and who constantly used the British Empire's own treaties, its fine print, and proclamations against itself. Creer refused to budge on the legal independence of the Transvaal. At first, Freer railed about how Creer was uncouth, repulsive, but over time he learned to respect Creer's tenacity. For officials who put the gung into ho when it came to expanding the British Empire, they would stand for no one in their way, particularly what they saw as a tawdry backwoods boor. The first years of Creer's presidency had been spent settling external affairs, revising the Pretoria Convention, hammering out agreements on the boundaries of the South African Republic. So when dollops of gold were found on the Witwatersrand, the ugly duckling of South Africa had been transformed into a plump and prosperous goose, as historian Frank Welsh puts it. Saul Jacobs formed his Langlachter Company 4 days after the two men who originally discovered the main reef, George Walker and George Harrison, signed their contract with the Boer owner of one of the sections of the farm. By the end of July 1886, a crowd of 600 diggers had rushed to the district and were camping on two main farms on the Witwatersrand, Turfontein and Doornfontein. Unlike the early rush to Kimberley, in this case there were no black diggers because of the discriminatory legislation which prohibited blacks from owning claims or any land in the Transvaal. The Suid-Afrikaanse Republiek had passed a law in 1885 explicitly excluding blacks from buying or working their own claims or even dealing in precious stones and metals. The Transvaal was practicing their own race-based legislature for a much more refined version which would pop up in the 20th century. In 1886, the energy was all about discovery and quick wins. Newcomers were turning up every day, trundling onto the farms south of the Witwatersrand Ridge in their ox wagons, their horse carts, their mule wagons, every sort of four- and two-wheeled vehicle. Others just walked. First, they came from Natal, the Cape, the Free State, Kimberley, some from Pretoria. Many headed for Ferreira's camp on the Turfontein farm. Colonel Ignatius Philip Ferreira was a veteran prospector who'd arrived in April. Born in Grahamstown in 1840, he'd been a member of the Frontier Police Force before heading to the Kimberley Diamond Fields, then the goldfields of Pilgrim's Rest. He'd fought in the First Anglo-Boer War of 1881 for the Boers, and despite his Portuguese surname, he was Dutch-speaking. Because he was the old prospector of Turfontein, younger diggers who arrived set up camp around his base, their makeshift shacks and scraggly tents dotted across the farm. He was tacitly accepted as their leader, and Turfontein Farm became known as Ferreira's Camp. It's ironic because many decades later, Turfontein suburb south of Johannesburg's CBD became the centre of a vibrant Portuguese-South African culture. Everything is connected. The first problem for these early diggers was their inability to mine properly because the Transvaal Volksraad had not proclaimed the farm's public diggings. Colonel Ferreira circulated a petition signed by hundreds of the diggers, and he took it to Pretoria on July 7th, requesting that the farms Langlachter and Turfontein be proclaimed a public goldfield. A few weeks later, he sent another petition that stated that they'd definitely found a workable goldfield on Langlachter, and that the farm should now be thrown open as a public digging in terms of Transvaal's gold law. Newspapers were now spreading the news. The Volksstem, the Transvaal Advertiser, the Cape Times, Diamond Fields Advertiser, the Afrikaner Patriot, the Natal Witness, all published stories spreading the news to a larger public. George Harrison, one of the two men who discovered Main Reef, as you heard last episode, had also sent an affidavit to the same effect, and on the strength of these two documents, the Volksraad finally decided to appoint a two-person commission to look into the claims. Transvaal Surgeon General Johan Rissik and Mines Department Head Christian Johannes Jabe began their investigation in early August. What they found was typical of early goldfields worldwide. Some of the gold claims being worked by diggers had already changed hands twice. There was such a frenzy. In what would later be described as remarkable foresight, Rissik and Joubert decided the goldfield was too complex to be worked by claim holders operating independently, as had been the case at Pilgrim's Rest and Kaapse Hoop. The cost of setting up crushers and deep-level digging was way beyond the capacity of small-scale gold miners. They would allow amalgamations of many claims, unlike the early Kimberley and Pilgrim's Rest fields. But there was another reason which haunts Johannesburg to this day. There was very little water, particularly during winter. Millions of litres were required to wash the ore and sieve the gold. No water, no mining. Providing water was going to cost a fortune, something beyond the cash flow of small operators. The second main decision taken by Rissik and Joubert was to identify where to set up a small town on the farm Rankieslaagte. It was roughly in the centre of the line of claims that ran east to west along the main reef outcrop between Roodepoort and Germiston of today. It was here that the mining village was constructed. Rankieslaagte was a triangular-shaped piece of land and lay between the farms Braamfontein to the west, Doornfontein to the east, and Turfontein to the south. The southern boundary of the farm lay along what is today's Commissioner Street, and two other boundaries, about 5 kilometres long, converged in the modern suburb of Hillbrow. And now to name the village. Here there's some dispute, you know, history. The exact origin of the name Johannesburg is a bit of a mystery. Some say Johannes Rissik and Johannes Joubert bestowed their name on the site, but others say it was because Paul Krier's middle name was Johannes. Perhaps it's a bit of both, and so it was that Krier formally approved the name of the mining village, and the Volksraad accepted the commissioner's recommendations to proclaim the whole area as a public goldfield. This process, by the way, had taken less than a month. Ah, that commissions would move that quickly. They also preferred granting mine licenses to properly financed corporations. Things would move quickly. The Volksraad gave the farm owners a month to make certain that the main pachtbrieven were in order. As I explained last episode, the main pacht or mining agreement gave the owner of the land an opportunity to place beacons on an area 1/10 the total farm size, on which the owner, him or herself, could conduct mining operations personally or authorize someone else to do it for them. They had received part of the rent and profits from the other 9/10 of the land being mined. Not like today, where the state owns the mining rights under the land. The Transvaal government appointed Carl van Brandes as the mining commissioner, with Jan Eloff as his assistant. Their names, of course, would be commemorated by the naming of Johannesburg streets, Eloff Street and van Brandes. Van Brandes was a German who'd fought in Austria and the Crimea before arriving in the Cape, where he hired himself out as a mercenary, fighting in various frontier wars against the Xhosa. Then he travelled to the Transvaal. As an educated man, he took up his role as a technocrat. It was van Brandes who was to proclaim the Witwatersrand goldfield and the mining village of Johannesburg. Yes, a German mercenary. So it was that the man who became known as the father of Johannesburg stood on a wagon outside his corrugated iron shack, which was his central Johannesburg office, and read out one of the most significant proclamations ever delivered in South Africa. It was a cool spring day, 20th of September, 1886. Van Brandes was watched by an audience of several hundred diggers, and he announced,
"Venus, it has become apparent to the government of South African Republic that it is desirable to proclaim the farms named Driefontein, Elandsfontein, Doornfontein, Turffontein, Rankieslaagte, Paardekraal, Langlaagte, Vogelstruisfontein, and Roodepoort, all situated on the Witwatersrand district of Heidelberg, as a public digging."
And with that, Egoli was born, the most lucrative gold mining industry the world would ever know. Up to now, of course. The main challenge, as mentioned, was water. Most of the farms have been called something Fontein for a reason. They were all located where springs flowed from the Witwatersrand ridge. Many of these springs dried up in winter. The second main challenge was equipment. Unlike Pilgrim's Rest and the Eastern Transvaal mines, Main Reef needed hardware that could work conglomerate rock. There was no mining machinery, no explosives, no transport. There were no proper roads and few general stores and no railway. Thus, the closing months of 1886 were dominated by entrepreneurs who spotted business opportunities. Their energies focused on delivering supplies and goods to the hundreds and then the thousands of new arrivals in Johannesburg. Mining claims began to change hands faster than a millennial losing money on Polymarket. More than 40 mining companies were established in a few weeks, with syndicates facing the massive capex requirements of at least £10,000 to pay for claim licenses and water rights, stamp batteries, lumber and wood, cement, dynamite, fuel, tools, wages, wagons, food, clothing. 3/4 of the first diggers were Boers from the Transvaal, counter to the narrative that all were Uitlanders or English speakers. Their problem was cash. Prior to the miraculous discovery of gold, the Transvaal, as I said, was the ugly duckling of South Africa, impoverished, while areas like the Eastern Cape were basking in the wool trade, or the Northern Cape, the diamond trade. So claims were sold off quickly. Claim holders knew their best chance of commercial success lay in their banding together and cooperating to work larger holdings. The pattern of early Johannesburg mine syndication thus began, a pattern that would be repeated hundreds of times in the future and up to the present. The owner of a block of claims would take partners, they would form a syndicate, then a company, which would then secure capital. Often this would mean amalgamating with a neighbouring company, and then two or three more. Finally, 6 or 8 smaller companies would be lumped together and consolidate their joint power. But who had the cash required to loan these new entities? Only those who had connections to finance, particularly European or American bankers, willing to take a chance on investing in South Africa. Those who'd built up these networks existed in South Africa, further south, in Kimberley. It was they who had built up hordes of cash and networks with financiers across the globe. This flourishing multi-million pound a year diamond industry was perfectly placed to seize the day. Both Kimberley and the Witwatersrand are similar in that there was a delay between the discovery of precious stones and rock and the truth that the reefs were workable to any depth. In Pilgrim's Rest, as in most parts of the world, early prospectors soon ran out of workable rock, pinched out as it's known. Was Johannesburg going to be another shallow disappointment? Early miners had no idea. Another obvious challenge from a financier's point of view was how much money was needed and when would they make their money back. Their return on investment percentage, their ROI, was unclear. The consolidation of cash and capital had already taken place in Kimberley and these investors were well placed to respond. You need money to make money. Without Kimberley, most gold mines would not have been able to kick-start their operations as quickly as they did back in 1886 and 1887. While the remote world of Europe and America viewed the Witwatersrand gold find as just another possible investment, for the Kimberley magnates, this was an opportunity afforded by locality. Back in Griqualand West, the magnates were at each other's throats, as the ultra-rich tend to be, vying for supreme control over South Africa's diamond production. Joseph J.B. Robinson was one of these. You've heard a bit about him already. He was a vindictive man, unliked and unlikable, and his bullying ways had backfired in Kimberley, particularly as he tried to dominate any business agreement, and none of the other magnates, including Cecil John Rhodes, would work with him. By 1886, J.B. Robinson had run up an £82,000 debt, and the Cape of Good Hope Bank held £100,000 of nominal share value in two of his companies as collateral against these loans. J.B. Robinson was in a slump, all right, his career slithering towards the chasm of bankruptcy, when news filtered in to his plush Kimberley mansion that gold was to be had on the Witwatersrand. Robinson was also one of the first diamond magnates to hear of the reef, with legend having it that he was sitting in the prestigious members-only Kimberley Club one July 1886 evening, drowning his many sorrows, when he was handed a telegram sent by former digger Charles Evans, which read, "A discovery has been made of a peculiar kind of conglomerate shedding gold freely. I think it is worth your while to come on at once and see it." Robinson, of course, had been reading about exaggerated finds of gold to the north for many years. The newspapers were full of Eastern Transvaal stories, but he had not yet decided to act on any reports. That's not to say that Robinson was cynical. He was a firm believer in the mineral potential of South Africa. Only recently, he'd been quoted in the Diamond Fields Advertiser, saying that the Transvaal was the richest mineral country in the world. It's amazing just how many decisions are taken following public demonstrations of some kind. In this case, it was fresh produce merchant and part-time gold digger Frederick Alexander. On July 14, 1886, he opened his store in Kimberley's Market Square and then panned some samples of conglomerate brought all the way from the Witwatersrand. The long tail of gold in his pan startled all who watched. Standing alongside Robinson watching this display was Cecil John Rhodes and his longtime partner Charles Rudd. And like Robinson, the demonstration was rich enough to stimulate more than just passing interest. Robinson, however, was on the verge of losing his business and needed financial support in his new quest for the Holy Golden Grail. He approached Alfred Beit, who in 1886 was worth more money than Cecil John Rhodes. Beit was planning to amalgamate his operations with Rhodes, and the plan, said Robinson, was about to ruin him. Robinson's sob story continued. His business would be liquidated unless he could produce other guarantees. That was a surprise. Robinson had never admitted to any weakness. And even more surprising, he opened up his balance sheets to Beit's scrutiny. It was clear from these sheets that the assets were sound. Robinson just had a cash flow problem. So Beit approached the Cape of Good Hope Bank with his own guarantee for all Robinson's liabilities and to take over all his securities. He didn't stop there. Beit hauled out £20,000 of his own moolah to fund Robinson's new venture on the Witwatersrand. Like all agreements between investors, Beit was acting in the tradition of enlightened self-interest. This wasn't a new characteristic in Beit's family. Their interest in gold and diamonds was an old tradition. This new syndicate was named the Robinson Syndicate, with a capital of $30,000 in total, including Beit and his business partner, Maurice Marcus. Beit had no idea, but this would prove to be the most lucrative investment he ever made. Next week, we'll follow the trail of more deals in the earliest days in Johannesburg, which are stories that must be heard to be believed. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, tot ziens.